Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 869 in Isleta Pueblo, I'm Tara Gatewood. Bread is found throughout the globe, including many versions that are feasted upon in our Native nations. First Nations in Canada have many varieties of bannock. Pueblos make fluffy loaves in outdoor ovens. Hopis make thin and crisp piki bread. And fry bread needs no introduction. Native breads made with contemporary or all indigenous ingredients have a special place in the home and special events. Join us as we celebrate the breads of our Native nations right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Leaders of a North Dakota group are hopeful they'll soon have a federal leader who identifies with them. New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland nominated for Secretary of the Department of the Interior. Mike Moen has more.
Nicole Donaghy of the group North Dakota Native Vote says not only would it be historic to see a Native in charge of a federal agency, to her the nomination brings hope that tribal lands have a defender who sees things through the same lens.
That understanding of the connection of how Indigenous people relate to the land and how we find that conservation is an important role in who we are as a people.
She says the previous administration often failed to consult with tribes when reviving controversial projects like the Dakota Access Pipeline. Haaland's nomination has drawn pushback from GOP House members in oil and mining-heavy districts who urge their Senate colleagues to consider her opposition to practices like fracking. Wes Davis, board chairman at North Dakota Native Vote, says he isn't surprised to hear arguments about canceled oil projects and their economic effect, but he believes Haaland's voice has credibility that can rise above political divisions.
She understands the ecosystem, you know, and how it relates to all people and the health of the world.
Davis says given the history of tribal property stolen by the federal government, Haaland could bring renewed energy to the movement to reclaim lands.
Not only in those treaty rights did we lose land, but we lost opportunity to hunt and fish on these lands.
During the Obama presidency, one North Dakota tribe was able to recover land taken by the Army Corps of Engineers.
That was Mike Moen reporting. Alaska State and Tribal Healthcare representatives joined members of the Alaska Native Community Thursday for a virtual wellness hour hosted by the group Native People's Action. They discussed COVID-19 vaccines. Dana Deal with the Wellness Department at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is helping the state with COVID-19 health equity response. She says communities are using key Alaska Native values of honoring elders, sharing, and caring in the vaccine rollout.
The value of sharing and taking care of others has also been amplified within our tribal health regions as part of the COVID response. And I think you see that in many of our tribal health organizations opening up the vaccine to all community members. I actually was talking to my mother-in-law, who's a Chupik elder from Chivac, and she shared with me that by opening up the vaccine to household members that are non-Native and other community members, we're truly practicing our Alaska Native value of sharing and inclusion.
There are 12 major tribal health regions in Alaska. Tribes across the United States have the option to receive vaccines through states or the Indian Health Service. Alaska tribal health programs are working with the state on COVID-19 vaccine distribution. They already have collaborations and infrastructure in place. Change the Name advocates are calling on the Kansas City football team to end its use of Native names and imagery as the team prepares to play in the Super Bowl. The group, Not in Our Honor, which includes Native Americans in the greater Kansas City area, recently amplified their message on two digital billboards in Kansas City reading Change Your Name and Stop the Chop and Racism KC. The coalition, which includes college students, leaders of Native organizations, and community members, held demonstrations all season outside the team's stadium. Coalition members are traveling to Florida to take part in demonstrations with other Indigenous groups outside Tampa Bay Stadium on Sunday. Planes have been rented to fly with banners with end racism messages around Tampa this weekend. Not in Our Honor partnered with the nonprofit Illuminative for a Super Bowl social media storm to draw attention to the Change the Name movement, calling on all sports teams to ban Native mascots and imagery. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing scholarships to Native students of every age for over 30 years. Applications for the upcoming school year accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org.
If you're a Native American expanding or starting a business, the Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program supports your lender so your lender can make the business loan you need. Info by emailing dci@bia.gov. The Office of Indian Energy and Economic Development supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, joining you live from my homelands of Shirwitui via Skype. Bread is a staple across the globe. It's an important part of many cultures. In Native America, many tribes have their own type of bread. Some are traditional, but many are more modern inventions. In Canada, First Nations have a variety of breads that go by the name Bannock. In New Mexico, each of the pueblos make a yeasted loaf of bread in an outdoor oven that uses volcano rocks. And the Hopis make piki bread from cornmeal. Other nations have a variety of wheat, corn, and nut bread. And we are highlighting the different kinds of breads that are prevalent in our tribal cuisines. And you can join our conversation too. What types of traditional and contemporary bread is your Native community known for? Who makes them, and what kind of work goes into making them? Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. Join our conversation, and what place do these loaves and flatbreads have in your Native culture and tradition? Share your thoughts, share your story, 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we're going to start off in Canada's British Columbia in Vancouver. We have Paul Natrell, and he is a second-generation chef, owner of Mr. Bannock Food Truck, and a member of the board of directors of the Indigenous Culinary Associated Nations. And he is Squamish. Our pleasure to have him here. Welcome to Native America Calling, Paul.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me today.
And so, Paul, we're going to turn to you to tell us a little bit about Bannock, what it is, how you make it. Go ahead.
Yeah, so here, like what I do up here in Canada is I call it a quick bread. And you can bake it, you can stuff it, it can be sweet or savory. We have it in tacos, we have it for burgers, we have it for pizzas. It's pretty like a utility, right? You can use it for almost anything, really.
And I know it finds its way into many kitchens and many bellies. And what does it taste like?
Yeah, it's, well, depending on what style you have, like fried bread is always pretty delicious. Anything deep fried is good, right? You get the nice crisp texture and fluffy goodness. And then we also do stone-baked bannock pizzas or loaves or whatever the clients that we have enjoy, right? Stone baking is one of the ancient cooking methods that we love to showcase, and we use it with our bannock mix.
And so, Paul, do you know the origins of bannock?
Yeah, there's many stories, as there is for everything, right? For sure.
And what have you heard about where it all came from?
Yeah, so the actual word bannock is non-Indigenous. It's from our Scottish friends, the settlers that came in and, came into everybody's territory. But up here in Canada, or like everywhere, like there's a version of a flatbread, right? Up here, my people used ground lichen and ash and water to form a paste, and they would cook it on hot rocks or a stick. So it would be very similar to a tortilla, right? And as every cuisine evolves, now we have these huge fluffy fried breads or bannock pizzas or loaves that everybody enjoys these days.
Sure. And, you know, these things have definitely gone a long way, and their introductions into our Native communities have a story of their own. And maybe you want to share some of that story. Go ahead and dial in. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And Paul, how important would you say bannock is to First Nations communities?
Yeah, it's a type of food that got our people through a lot of hardships in the past, right? And it was like survival mode, right? But now it's a bit more of a luxury thing. Like, not everybody needs to have it, but they enjoy it. Moderation is key always in things that taste good.
And Paul, when would you say you tasted bannock for the first time? Do you remember when?
Yeah, it was when I was a very little kid. Both of my grandmothers made different types. One did the fried bread and the other did the baked. And both of the houses were on the same block, so it was very close and delicious. Like, my company's called Mr. Bannock, but till this day, it's like I can't match up to how my grandmothers did it, but it's very good.
Yeah, grandma's cooking. Oh, boy. Mama's cooking. Oh, boy. And Paul, tell us more about Mr. Bannock Food Truck.
Yeah, so I started back in 2017, and my commissary kitchen's called Pierre Bannock Factory, and it was a catering company, and we did all the farmers markets and the night markets, and everybody became to know me as the Bannock guy. So as time evolved, I got the name Mr. Bannock, and I created Vancouver's first Indigenous food truck, Mr. Bannock. And we have a variety of types of bannock. And we have tacos, burgers, we've done pizzas, we did calzones, and they're all from the bannock mix that we have. So it's a big variety.
And where do people find Mr. Bannock? Are there certain places where the truck goes? Or tell me a little bit about accessing Mr. Bannock's food truck.
Yeah, we're on the reserve here in North Vancouver. And due to the pandemic, we're open on Fridays. We have limited services right now. Hopefully in the near future, as all the vaccines come in, we'll get back to normal. And you'll see us at a lot of community events once everything opens up. But until then, we're open on Fridays. Spring's around the corner. Hopefully we'll add another day or two during the week. And we also have some of our products online at MrBannock.com that people can get shipped right to their door. So that was a big pivot that we did during the pandemic.
Wow, we'll have to check that out. And Paul, for you, what does it mean to be able to give folks this kind of food? And maybe, you know, people don't make this all the time, but when they see your truck, it takes them back home, reconnects them to loved ones, mom, grandma, uncles, everybody.
Yeah, it's huge. Like, there's, before the pandemic, we were at every big community event because we're Vancouver's only Indigenous food truck, right? And a lot of people that grew up on the North Shore, where I'm from, they haven't had bannock since elementary school. And I'm 37 years old, and it's usually people around my age and a bit older that hasn't had it since then, right? Everybody traveled to the longhouse. That's a cultural thing up here. In Squamish, that's about an hour away, and they had traditional cooking up there. So we did bannock on a stick, and we made a salmon stew with hot rocks and cedar baskets and stuff like that. It was a really awesome experience when I was younger. That's definitely one of the highlights of indigenous food culture for sure.
Well, very nice. And Paul, it's very nice to meet you. I know you got to get going here. And very interesting to just kind of start off our conversation in Canada. We're talking all kinds of breads that come from our tribal nations. You just heard from Mr. Bannock, food truck, Paul Natrell, who's here with us. If you want to join us too, share some thoughts. What type of breads come from your community? 1-800-996-2848. Also here, too, out of Augusta, Georgia, is Dave Smoke McCluskey. He is a chef and owner of Corn Mafia, and he is Mohawk. Our pleasure to have him here. Dave, welcome to Native America Calling.
Well, thanks. Great to be here.
Great to have you on the line. Dave, what do you think about what you heard about Bannock? You hungry?
It's interesting. I just ate lunch. No, I'm not hungry right now. But Bannock sounds great. I've never had it. I've of course had fried bread and things like that. Regular kind of old colonialish cornbread or cornbread without flour in it. Pretty traditional here in the South.
And Dave, sometimes people. That's their introduction into Native cuisine are these type of breads. And when people's interest is piqued about our indigenous foods, you know, it's kind of an invitation in to come and learn more. And for you, what do you think about people being introduced to our Native nations via food?
Well, I think it's a great starting point. Corn is obviously a kind of a ubiquitous item for all of us to sink our teeth into as an entry to Native cuisine, because it's, you know, hey, it's ours. So it doesn't really matter to me if it's got flour in it or not. It still has the corn in there. So I don't usually use flour in the cornbread. Traditionally, as a Mohawk, we make a boiled cornbread. So
think of the details of what goes into it. It tells a story on its own. Dave, I want to hear exactly how you make that coming up after the break. But again, if you want to join us, tell us your tribe's bread story. 1-800-996-2848 is a number. We look forward to your calls, your stories, or just hearing about some of these breads that are, you know, have a special place in our communities. Maybe it's reminding you of someone and you wish you had a piece of it right now. Call in. 1-800-996-2848 is the number to join us. In less than 3 weeks in office, President Joe Biden reversed a slew of immigration policies enacted by Donald Trump. The stack of executive orders includes protecting asylum seekers and halting work on wall construction at the U.S.-Mexico border. We'll discuss what this means for indigenous people on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo. Today we're talking about bread. Many tribes have their own special type. And what traditional breads are made in your community? When and where do these breads come from? And how are they featured on your family or community's table? Join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Or maybe you just want to tell me what is best to dip your tribal bread in. Call now. We're looking forward to your stories. 1-800-996-2848. With us today out of Augusta, Georgia, is Dave Smoke McCluskey, and he is chef and owner of Corn Mafia. He's Mohawk. Our pleasure to have him here. And Dave, you were just about to start telling us a little bit about some of the great flavors you make with corn bread. Tell me more. Tell me about the style you make and what you call it.
Sure. We're a small batch of hominy company, and so we first start out our process with our cornmeals and grits and flours and whatnot with the whole process of making hominy from hardwood ash. So a lot of that process is what we now refer to as nixed mulsation. You'll hear that word bandied about. And we refer to it as lying corn. So it's a chemical process that has many different uses. One of those is that it in the absence of gluten, this whole process produces a weak gel as it melts the outer shell of the corn and allows it to kind of stick together. So we kind of preserve that as part of our technique with the corn, depending on the amount of washes and the usage that we're doing it for. So one of those usages is when we do our flour or our masa, as is traditionally known in further south, is to make a almost like a tamale dough or a masa dough, and we add beans to it, and we form those into round shapes or patties, if you will. And then we boil them. So that's our cornbread. So it's a corn and bean bread that's boiled pretty much until it floats. And then we can serve it afterwards with something to dip it in. You know, sometimes it's butter, sometimes it's lard, sometimes it's sunflower oil or it's hickory nut oil. It really depends on what you have around. Some of the more favorite ways to eat that are to slice it when it cools, and then to fry it in a little bit of bear fat or bacon fat or whatnot after that. So, or butter. That's just one of the types of cornbread that we make. Those are a little bit different. We make a kind of traditional kind of a skillet cornbread as well. One with flour, one without. I kind of like the one without flour. It's really just a bit of cornmeal, some eggs, some salt. And it goes into in some butter usually, but you can use any type of fat. Pork fat works great, but that goes into a hot skillet and then goes in the oven and comes out. And it's when you don't use flour, it's a little more crumbly, but this one's great out of the oven like that. So colonizers make a similar bread and it's got flour in it and it kind of sticks together a little bit firmer, which is how I'm assuming that the bannock is. But we also make, with our cornmeal, we also make what we refer to as hoe cakes, which are generally cooked dry on a hoe on the edge of a fire. And that was really a bread more so than it was a pancake that they've kind of become today. So a whole bunch of different things there.
Yeah, in these varieties, it also varies, too, on who's making them. And sometimes people can tell who made the bread just by tasting them or how they look. And maybe that's something you're proud of that you can tell. Mom's bread from grandma's bread, from your sweetie's bread. You can tell us about it by dialing in 1-800-996-2848. And Dave, for you, these different types of breads, what do they represent, especially when it comes to who we are as Indigenous people?
Well, to me, it really promotes our unique indigeneity. Just because of the corn usage and you know, we're the pros at cooking with it. So I think it really kind of helps us to all shine in a way. I'm a firm believer in reminding everyone that corn was first cultivated here in the Americas almost 10,000 years ago. So we have a rich tradition in agriculture as well as in cuisine and eating things like this. So very proud of the corn that we process. We try to process as much indigenous corn as we can find and get our hands on. Secondly, we go to heirloom corns, and sometimes thirdly, we'll go to organic corns, depending on what we're finding in the marketplace. So, but I really stress on trying to use the indigenous corns and promoting those more so than any of the others, because there's just it's a way for our people to make some money and hopefully bring back plantings of more corn. And that's really what our small batch company is about. So at the moment I'm grinding Cherokee white flour corn. I'm also grinding a little bit of white, an heirloom variety referred to as Hickory King corn. So we use a lot of that here in the South.
And tell me about the different varieties, you know, versus heirloom corn or organic corn. Tell me more.
Well, let me kind of start this off in advance. Sometimes it's a controversial view. My belief that even the heirloom corns and the organic corns that are often crossbreeds of our traditional native corns are still our corns, if you will. So I don't always view them as completely different. They're all part of the same family, if you will. So picture somebody being born off the reservation that's kind of coming home. So I kind of claim all of the corns, even though some are kind of like redheaded stepchildren, like the Monsanto corn. Ultimately, it's still our corn, and we've cultivated it. But what I'm trying to promote is the use of our indigenous corns, much like the Cherokee corn that I'm using a lot of. That's from the Eastern Band, just up in North Carolina, not too far from me. So what I'm trying to do here is trying to get people to grow more of our corn as they're saving it, because as our climate changes, we need to grow that corn out to get it acclimated to the new climate that's kind of happening everywhere where we're at. So to do that efficiently, you need to grow sometimes several acres of the corn to start picking corn out or picking seed out. So what I'm trying to be able to do is to get people to be able to, or farmers to make those grows. Well, if you make that 5-acre grow, you've got a lot of corn to get rid of. So what I'm trying to do is trying to be a fair trade person in that endeavor and sell that corn, but also protect the seed by creating hominy from that seed. So from farmer to me, the seed is still a viable product, but once it gets to me, it's no longer viable as a planting corn to anyone else. So we're also keeping seed sovereignty there. So kind of important to me, kind of important to a lot of seed savers and farmers as well. But I'd like people to make money. So, you know, growing corn isn't always cheap. So we need to have some of, well, we need to have fair prices, just like we do with coffee. And, you know, commercial commodity corn goes anywhere from 45 cents to a dollar a pound. Excuse me. And that doesn't, you know, that doesn't cut it with the yields that our older traditional corns have, which are not as great as those commodity corns. Commodity corns are designed to put out dozens of bushels an acre, and it's really all about volume. It's not about flavor, where our corns are really about the terroir of the land and growing where they're from and the taste. So huge differences there, but when you throw it all into the kind of commercial system that exists here in America, there's no grading there, so it's all just corn. So it's white corn, yellow corn, blue corn, red corn. So you're going to get the same prices, whether it's better corn or not. So if you're trying to sell it in a commercial fashion, you're not going to make as much. But when you sell it to me, who's a small batch hominy guy, I sell it to folks that are willing to pay those prices and realize what that corn is. So that could be chefs,
sure,
or foodies.
And sure,
or
you can feel it in the taste. Very interesting. And Dave, if people do want to connect with you, where do they find you?
Right now I'm all small batch, so they could find me at Corn Mafia on Instagram. I'm just setting up a website now, which will be, you know, in the next week or so will be up under thecornmafia.com. I've been kind of doing small batch word of mouth sales for the past two months. And, my partner and I are just slowly starting to throw some of the commercial aspects together here.
Well, very nice. I'm glad we caught up with you in this phase. If you want to talk to Dave, call in 1-800-996-2848. We do have a caller. We're going to say hi to Shell, who's in Fort Hall, Idaho, tuned in on KISU. Shell, thank you for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Appreciate you. I'm Omwash. Tara. Good morning, Tara. A little bit of history. Bannock, from southeastern Idaho, was originally Panakwet, the people of the river, the Snake River. So the English translation was sure it was Bannock. But we harvested in the base, the Great Basin area, for about thousands of years, a plant called camas, which they harvested and they crushed it down on flat stones and made it into kind of like biscuits or a big, large cookie, or sometimes into pudding. And And that's how they would, it would vary from year to year. So they had kind of like these old oven-like places, you know, kind of like the, maybe like similar to the way the Pueblos made their ovens out of the earth and made around, and that's where they'd camp out for the season. It was kind of like different areas would be different seasons. So that's kind of like the pudding part was really good, you know, like they would, how they process it the ancient way and how they would hold it over an open fire or hot rocks, and it would turn into something, you know, really delicious, you know.
It sounds delicious, Shell. Well, thank you for giving us a ring, teaching us a thing or two there out of Fort Hall, Idaho. You can teach us too at 1-800-996-2848. And right now we're going to go to Second Mesa, Arizona. On the line with us today is Susan Sikea-Kwaptewa, and she is an assistant agent for the Hopi Tribe Cooperative Extension Program. And she is Hopi. Our pleasure to have her here. Welcome to Native America Calling, Susan.
Good morning. It's a beautiful morning. Thank you for inviting us.
It is. And Susan, hearing about these different types of what some would call breads and thinking of what you make there in your home community, what are your thoughts? Are there some crossovers, especially the way things you heard the two gentlemen talk about, the way their foods were made? Any crossovers?
Well, the fry bread, I think, is pretty universal of Indian country, so we have that here. I've heard of bannock. I've tasted it before, but I agree with the gentleman. You know, Indian people were so industrious, were so creative. We've learned to make some beautiful foods out of the foods that we've grown from our regions, and that's what I hear from them in relation to who we are here in the Southwest.
Mm-hmm. Now, Susan, Piki. Piki is famous in my book, and people run for it, too, when it's available. And it also plays a very important role in tradition. So introduce us to what Piki bread is and a little bit of what goes into it and how it's made.
Okay, that's a big question. Piki is a Hopi traditional bread made from blue cornmeal. It's made by the women in the community, and it's used in every cultural event that we have in our culture, from the birth of a child all the way to the death of a person and everywhere in between. It's considered a spiritual food, so it's regarded highly for the making of it, the knowledge of it, having it on hand and being able to contribute that to any ceremonial activity. But it's also a staple, or it used to be a real staple of our diets, because blue cornmeal was pretty abundant in our community. So it's would be served probably mostly every meal, or it's very light, so you could pack it, although it's really dry, so it could crush. It's really filling as well. Even though it's very light in taste, it will fill you up. It's got very low fat, so it's very healthy for you. It's just a really all-around amazing bread. How it's made is it's made with blue cornmeal that's grown in the community, and it's the corn, once it's harvested and brought home, is then processed by the females, who will fully dry it. They'll crack it, roast it, and then grind it into a finer meal. And then that meal is mixed with water and a little bit of an ash that's made from a bush here in the Southwest. And that ash just helps release some of the vitamins in the meal that help our bodies absorb the nutrients in it. But it also turns the meal slightly bluer in color. Otherwise, it's a very gray, dark gray color. And it's made so you have to learn how to make the batter. That batter is then placed using your hand on the hot stone that's heated by a fire. And then you'll pull off a sheet of once it's cooked, and then you'll lay another batter down, and then the steam from that batter will allow that first sheet that you made, if you lay it on top of it, the steam will help make it supple enough to fold. And then it's fold and rolled. And then so they end up, for the most part, in like 10-inch rolls that are with several, one big sheet that's rolled up into many layers. And then it's stored and dried for a couple of days. And it can store for easily 6 months or more as well. So it's really great to preserve.
In this whole process, there's a lot of delicate touch work that goes on with it. And anything more you want to say about that, that you really got to take your time and be careful with it, Susan?
Definitely. Well, we first of all, you know, the whole process begins with the growing of the corn. Really, the men and the male parts of our community are the ones responsible to grow the corn. They're active farmers. And it really begins with them growing it out, the seed, and having that harvest enough. And then once it comes home, you know, the women take over and process the whole part of it. So it really does take both genders to have a full allowance of a corn stalk in your pantry. But for females and the women in the community.
Hang tight. We got to go to break here. And I want to hear more about that balance and really what it brings, because a lot of times when we have some of our traditional foods, you think about what you're putting in your mouth or what's being there on the table, but it has a story and an origin that goes back beyond what's sitting on the plate. If you'd like to add to that, go ahead and call in to 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Dial in now. We're ready for your calls and we're ready for your stories. 1-800-996-2848 or 1-800-99-NATIVE is how you get into the conversation.
If you're a Native American entrepreneur looking to expand or start up a business, you should know about the Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program, a federal program encouraging private lenders to make the business loan you need. The Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program supports your lender so your lender can support you. Information available by emailing dci@bia.gov. That's dci@bia.gov. The Office of Indian Energy and Economic Development supports this program.
Thanks for joining us today here on Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, and we're talking breads, the kind you eat. And what is the story that comes from your tribal nation? Is there a type? And what's your favorite thing to eat with it? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Go ahead and dial in. Here with us today out of Second Mesa, Arizona, is Susan Sikiakwapdewa, and she is an assistant agent for the Hopi Tribe Cooperative Extension Program. Our pleasure to have her here. And Susan, you were talking a little bit about the different things that go into making this type, making piki, and the balance between genders and the role that they play at different parts in this. Go ahead and expand more, because this is really important.
Yeah, I believe all cultures... Native cultures particularly had a real sense of roles and parts you play in the community, and Hopi was no different. There's certainly cultural roles that we all have and grow up learning, and how that identifies how we contribute to the community. And in Hopi, the farming part, because we are an agrarian culture, we are farmers. A big part of our life is focused around farming for food. And so the male counterparts of the community learn how to actually grow a lot of that. They learn those techniques, those processes. They start learn when they're very young, and the men begin teaching the younger ones to grow that food. So that's a big part of their responsibility of growing that out. And then once it's harvested and brought back to their homes, they gift it to their wives if they're married, or their daughters or mothers if they're not, or their if they're not married, to their mothers. And then it's the women who then accept it into our home as an extension of our family. That's really how we look at it. This food that has been grown and out in our fields, surrounding areas, are really part of our family. And it's all that is acknowledged and brought in. We as women then care for that and begin utilizing and processing it, storing some for seed, and then using a lot more to use as food. And then we take up that role to learn all the different meals and dishes to prepare and offer that back out to our families and our communities to feed the village and anybody else who comes to eat, right? Because you're always inviting everyone to come eat with you. So that's really the exchange and balance that we have, and we recognize that we can't do it alone. We do need each other, and the importance of family is a big part of that work.
And something also in this is the stone, which is an important part of being able to make Biki. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, the Biki stone is Biki is made. There's a whole little place set aside just to make this bread. There's a little house usually that's belongs to a family that's outside of the main living space, and that's an extension of a Hopi kitchen. Really, there's a stone that's set on a fire hearth inside that little house, and that's where the Biki is made. The women will prepare to make that. So there's a lot of, if you make it in the traditional way, which a lot of people still do, is having a stone, which in itself is a lot of knowledge of learning how to prepare or cure those stones. So those stones and little houses are usually passed down in the family line through the female line. And one family may have one stone, so they all share, you know, access to that space. You need wood, a pile of wood, because that's how you heat the stone. So making sure you have that supply handy. Part of curing the stone is using certain fats. So learning how to prepare those fats as you make the biki in between. And then learning how to make the batter, which is another step. It needs to be a certain consistency. And you as the more you do this, the more you just figure out what that means for you, because even when we make this, it's all, everybody has their own little preferences as well. Like some can make it thinner or thicker. And then learning to heat the stone. The stone is heated with fire, so you need to learn how to regulate your stone on what temperature you can make it at, or what you prefer to make it at based on your batter. And the whole process takes, for a large batch, probably 5 to 6 hours to invest, maybe. A smaller batch, of course, a couple hours less, but you're sitting in that space for those many hours and assuring that you have all these supplies in hand before you start. So it's a big investment, and it's not something you learn easily or very fast. It really is a technique that you're just have to invest your time in learning. There's no classes, there's no books you read. It's just how we've always learned things, by doing it, making time for that. So if you have little girls in your family, you would introduce them to that while you're making it. Women visit with each other while they're in that little tumsuki, the name of the biki house, and that's how they visit and support one another maybe. So it's a really beautiful time, but it is a big investment, a wonderful thing to learn.
And much appreciated. And maybe you've never heard the full story of how it's made and these different kind of connections. You have some thoughts. You've tasted Biki before, but you didn't know this side of it. You can call in too. 1-800-996-2848 is a number. And if you were brought up making any of the things you've heard on the program today and want to share your thought, or just pay tribute to those who pass the knowledge on to you, you can call right now. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Let's hear what people are thinking across the nation. We're going to say hello to Michael, who is in Jemez Pueblo, tuned in on KUNM. Michael, thanks for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. In the Southwest and the Pueblo, especially the Pueblo world, we have that oven bread, and a lot of people talk about it from other tribes because we have feast days that are mostly in the summertime, and also Christmas celebrations with a big spread out on the table, and the main bread is an oven bread, which is made outside in an orno or oven, and that oven is heated with wood, like the previous person said. And also, to regulate the heat inside the oven, usually the charcoal and everything is wiped out with a long pole that with cloth at the end, dipped in water, and the coals are pulled out of the oven. But then, you know, we use corn husks to throw inside around the bottom of the floor to see if the oven is too hot. If the oven is too hot, then you get that rag, dip it in water, swash it around the floor, and then throw corn husk in there, and then it tells you when the right temperature is. Or if it's not hot enough, then you reheat it with burning some more wood, and then after that the oven bread goes in there, and all the smell, and then the children always delight and say, you know, they want to put butter on it right away as soon as it comes out of the oven, because all the smell and the taste with that fresh butter on it. And also we have tortillas, and then
that fresh bread. And then sliding some butter over it. Boy, that is just, you know, good stuff. Thank you for that, Michael. I got some other callers I got to go to. Appreciate your call. They're in Jemez Pueblo. We now go to Wounded Knee, South Dakota, to hear Joyce, who's on the line. Joyce, thanks for giving us a ring. Go ahead. You're on air.
Thank you again for the information of your program today. My interjection of bread to this conversation is we have a bread named for the season that we go out to do the work. And the work is picking potatoes, and therefore our bread is named Barapahi Ahuapi, or bread when you pick potatoes, it would be a definition. And that is simply made on the fire built outside, and just the same as any other bread that we have in being sold in everything. Other nations enjoy a similar way of making the bread. When I would say that my mother would just come back early from picking potatoes, and about a half an hour early, and she'd get the dough mixed up, and then she'll get the fire started outside, because we lived in tents when we went to pick potatoes. So we would all sit and watch her as she would place the dough inside of the skillet. And many times it came out at least 2 inches in height. It was very good when it came off of the skillet and it was just cooked outside. So the flavor of the bread is different. It looks like you're sitting there eating some of the outside wind, because if you make the same bread inside of the house, that flavor is gone.
So sure, that element of being outside too, that brings in and that relation to our environment and the land. Joyce, I'm glad you called in. It's good to hear your voice. Thank you for giving us a ring there in Wounded Knee. Got one more call. We got Stephen in Turtle Mountain, North Dakota, tuned in on KABU. Stephen, thanks for calling. Go ahead. You're on air.
Yes. My name is Stephen Belgard from the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewas over in North Dakota. Who would think that a simple thing as bread would be, shall I say, honored? Through the years, bread has been a mainstay of many tribes. It during hard times, we ate bread, whatever we can get from the land. And I'm from that generation whereby families, all they had was a little bit of bread. And as a young boy, I would go from house to house to visit. I would be welcomed, and they would bring out the bread, and we would eat, my friends and I. Times, hard times, but we all survived. And I have one more thing to say. Bannock, if I remember right, was also called galette. Mm. It was good bread.
Yep. The more I hear about it, sounds good. Thank you for giving us a ring there, Stephen. And right now we're going to go to Fort Defiance, Arizona. We have Grace Tracy on the line. She is a traditional plant-based teacher at Fort Defiance Medical Center. And she is Dene. Our pleasure to have her here. Grace, welcome. And please feel free to further introduce yourself.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for introducing me and inviting me to your program. My name is Grace Tracy. I introduce myself and my clanship within the Navajo system, Navajo clan system. So what I do here is I'm a teacher for plant-based traditional foods. The foods that I prepare is really just the three main ingredients, which is the ground corn, ground roast corn, the juniper ash, and the boiling water. And that's all I use in my traditional foods. And providing these traditional foods is really, it does not require the white bleach or unbleached flour, eggs, sugar, butter, or whatever the processed food entails in making bread. So it's really about just the three or four main ingredients that is in the traditional breads. So what I'm going to talk about is the kneel down bread. Mm-hmm. That's what it's called in Navajo, kneel down bread. It is fresh ground corn, the first harvest that you have, the green, the young corn. You process it through the grinder or your stone ground. You grind it for like maybe several minutes. You can get like maybe a dozen corn, get all the corn husk off, and prepare your batter, which is just the stone ground corn. That's it. You don't add salt, you don't add sugar, nothing, just the corn itself. And make it into a tamale shape. You use the same corn husk, the green corn husk. You spread it, put your batter in the middle, make it like a tamale. Fold the sides in, the top one folds back. So if you really look at it and you wonder, why is it called kneel down bread? Because the top is fold back like a knee. When you're sitting down, your legs are fold back. So that's how the corn husk is fold back. That's why it's called kneel down bread. And you, when you put it into the hot oven, which is the ground, you fix the earth, you remove all the ashes, separate all that, and then you line the corn, the bread, in the line, and then you cover it with a sheet of metal, and then you put the fire on top. You cook it for an hour. The steam itself really cooks the corn. And it's a really great recipe because it doesn't have a lot of processed ingredients. To me, it is organic. It's organic food that when you bring it from the cornfield, when you prepare it, it's all natural. And there's no added anything to it, and that's how some of the cooking that I prepare here at the hospital. We have a cafeteria where I'm doing all the plant-based cooking, and we're introducing more of the blue corn, like the tamales, the dumplings, the cookies, and all that. So that's part of the stuff that I'm preparing here.
Wow, and talk about healing, you know, our foods. They definitely are healing, and to know that this is something that is accessible at this place is really, really inspiring. And Grace, I really appreciate you being here today. And you know what? It feels like we could go on and on talking about different breads of our communities. Maybe there's something more you want to share. You can always leave things to us or leave notes to us on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. We've got to wrap things up here. Thank you to everybody that we heard from. Grace Tracy, Paul Nutral, Susan Sikeya Kwaptewa, and also Dave Smoke McCluskey. We hope you'll join us again Monday. There's more ahead next week. I'm Tara Gatewood.
Support by Utah Dene Bekea, working to fully restore Bears Ears National Monument by asking the Biden administration to fulfill the original vision of protection for 1.9 million acres with meaningful co-management by tribes. It's time we respect ancestral lands and our collective American heritage by listening to and learning from tribes on stewardships of these cultural landscapes. Info on supporting this effort at utahdene.org. That's UTAHDINE.org.
Cachet, be your own sweetheart this year. Make sure your heart is healthy enough to hold all your love. Contact your local Indian healthcare provider for more information. Visit healthcare.gov or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Ella Kwan.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.